Dogs, swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm. If you work, be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. The Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Well, shiver me timbers. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network, WPRPN. Live streaming today from under refreshingly clear and sunny South Korean skies, you're listening to episode number 63 of Pirate Radio Podcasts. I'm your host, as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. No guard could break him, no prison could hold him. Joining us tonight over speakerphone via California's Coalinga State Mental Hospital, illusionist, martial arts master, and accomplished escape artist, James Heidrich, a.k.a. Zane Leopard, a.k.a. Sir James, a.k.a. James Schrock. Over the course of our approximate 90-minute conversation, we'll aim to shed further light on Heidrich's intriguing life story. From his years of childhood abuse to growing up in multiple foster homes, rise to fame in the 1980s, recruitment into a covert super soldier program, to prison stories, including Charles Manson, Sirhan Sirhan, the Alphabet Bomber, and more. Our apologies to everyone who tuned in to last week's live streaming show featuring Deborah Ross So of Ghost Seekers Paragon. Plagued by technical issues and peculiar interruptions, theories as to why this was the case range anywhere from active sabotage to amateur inexperience. Fingers crossed, we're hoping today's epic presentation will come off without a hitch and manage to pretty much offer a little bit of something for everyone. Indeed we are, hoping that things come off without a hitch. Unfortunately, it looks like with the people that we do have joining us now live via YouTube, the streaming feed that we have up there, at the moment that they are telling us that they cannot hear anything as far as the sound is concerned. So that leaves us in a bit of a lurch for sure. James, do we have you there on the other end?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, well, that's great. Well, and the way that we got things set up here today, a little different than what we're normally used to. We've got you on speakerphone. Typically, we run things through Skype. So we've tried to boost your levels as best we can. We're just going to have to take it from here, frankly. We've really got no time to Mickey Mouse around and, without really kind of just flying into things here. And there's a lot of ground to cover here, basically, is what I'm trying to say. So, hey, thanks for being a part of the show today and joining us from Coalinga. What a story you've got to tell, that's for sure. And the best place to start, I suppose, would be your rise to fame in the mid-1980s, I guess it was. That's mostly how people came to know you. Why don't you? You appeared, of course, on That's Incredible and What's My Line with Bob Barker. A lot of the videos can be seen via YouTube. Why don't you explain to listeners what it was that you were trying to present exactly? Because you were, you were an illusionist presenting skills of telekinesis and so forth. Can you just break that down for people and refresh their memories, if you would?
Sure. First of all, thank you for giving me an opportunity to be heard. And I appreciate your audience having an interest in my story. Now, are you able to hear me okay?
We're doing the best we can here. Just as I said, with levels boosted and everything, it's not going to be ideal, but we're just going to have to make the most of it. You go ahead.
First of all, my martial arts skills were the key factors and whole objective throughout my career. My illusions were used as a mechanism in order to recruit students to train them in martial arts and other aspects of combat. I started very young. I was abused as a child by my family, my father and my stepmother, very badly. Being taken to the trees with the dogs, fed alpo, forced to eat out of the hog slop, to sleep in a chicken coop at night, and this went on for 6 months until they were caught by the South Carolina Child Services Division. Martial arts came in as a child when I was at the chain gang with my father in South Carolina. I saw a movie with Bruce Lee called Little Boy Chung, and I saw how he was using his hands and his feet in order to defend himself. I surmised if I could learn something like that, that I would probably be able to protect myself, my brother, and my sister from the physical abuse that we were being subjected to at the time, 1963, 64, 65. Later, ran into a gentleman, Robert Fletcher, who introduced me to karate in 1969, after I had been subjected to abuse for many years by adults. I learned very young not to trust adults, and I learned the difference between a lie and the truth by facial expression and body language. I later was introduced to a gentleman by the name of Harry Blackstone Jr. in Greenville, South Carolina.
You personally met Harry Blackstone Jr., is that right? Just to be clear here?
Blackstone Jr., yeah.
All right, well, that's something that, that's news to me.
Yeah,
well,
I met Harry Blackstone Jr. in 1972 in Greenville, South Carolina, and I later was with Harry Blackstone Jr. in Los Angeles when I did That's Incredible. He was there with me in 81, in Los Angeles when I filmed That's Incredible, the first episode. As a child, when I was 11 years old, Harry Blackstone Jr. showed me some illusions, and I was able to interpret what he was doing, tell him what he was doing without disclosing it to other people, and he thought that was fascinating that I had an eye for magic. He gave me a book, a magic kit, and some personal advice in his card, that told me that when I got of age to give him a call and he would help better my career. I saw it as an opportunity to consolidate illusions with martial arts. This is in the 70s. So I started focusing on utilizing martial arts and illusion as a mechanism to recruit people into martial arts, because it was something that no one else done. I saw them going hand to hand. It was like it was night and day to me, because I could use illusion as a mechanism of distracting my opponent or the enemy in order to take advantage of him combatively. Of course, later on, I ended up meeting other people, Grandmaster Wayne Frey, Wake Kim, Virgil Kimmy, Grandmaster Dave Durman, Ed Parker, Professor Tanaki, the Tanaki Clan, Steven Seagal, and other martial artists, some not known, that are just as powerful as the ones I just cited. And they indicated that my style of martial art was something they had never seen before. Now, because I wasn't able to read or write very well because of the medication that I was placed on as a child, because I was hyperactive in Whitten Village, that's in Clinton, South Carolina, the South Carolina Department of Mentally Retardation. I was mistakenly declared to be mentally retarded at the age of 9 and placed there on the 31st of December, or February 14, 1969. I stayed there until the 31st of December, 1975. While I was there, I enhanced my abilities in martial arts, spent a lot of time in the woods, ran away numerous times to the Savannah River, which is 40 miles away from where I was and stayed on the Savannah. And I just remember reviewing shows, the Kung Fu series with David Carradine, and other shows which I was able to mimic to a degree that was far more advanced than normal people. I have no idea why. It's no different, I thought, than you looking at a video on how to repair a carburetor and me looking at combat and being able to understand human nature when it comes to combat, body language, and aggressive action. Do you have any questions at this point?
Oh, well, you know, of course, yeah. Quite a few questions. One of the things, and thank you for that, the backstory, essentially kind of overview of things regarding your troubled youth and how you came to gain an interest in the martial arts, the numerous influences and teachers that you had over the years and whatnot. That Harry Blackstone Jr. reference was, that's, as I said, news to me. Just to quickly going to update everyone here, it's great to see that we do have a good quality feed from the sounds of things, so that's a bonus. Listeners via YouTube stating that they can hear the stream loud and clear, which is great. We, as once again last week, things did not come off so well as far as the technical end of things, so we're hoping to bounce back from that and manage to put together a more decent quality overall package here for people. So big shout out to the listeners that we do have here via YouTube, of course, Zane Ivy, Oscar Lopez. He's a newbie, I guess. I think he might be one of those people from Mines, though, as well, too. Mr. Animation Guy, if I'm not mistaken. But we'll see about that. And, of course, Faceless Troll. I'm not sure if we have anyone else in there at the moment. But as things go, there tends to be more of a build-up as the show goes on, generally, each week. So let's talk about your... Well, you kicked around, of course, you know, I'm not sure how many foster homes, quite a few, though, is what it sounds like. And I think anyone that has looked into your story does have some sympathy for you, of course, because, I mean, what a life, what a, like, as far as the youth was concerned in particular, the way that you were treated, as you said, being left out, tied to a tree in the backyard and made to eat Elpo for 6 months. That's a pretty bitter pill to swallow. But let me just... Sure, James, go ahead.
One of the reasons that I, when I did become a public image, I stated to the world, I had learned my training from a Shaolin priest or a monk, and that I had studied in the Shaolin temple. The reason I came out with that story initially, and your show is the first show that I have ever admitted this to. I have never told anyone this before, so this is a first time exclusive with you. The only reason that I told people that my training and my skills came from a priest of the Shaolin Temple in the Hunan province is because I was ashamed of the way I was brought up. Because I was an abused child, that no one would ever take me serious. And no one would ever believe that I was able to overcome the tragedy that I overcome with my stepmother, who constantly told me that I would never amount to anything, that I was a piece of shit, and that I would die as a child, not loved by anyone. She did everything she could to make that come true. She fought to set the house on fire with me in it. And my brother and sister nailed the windows down, removed the doorknob from the house so that we couldn't get out. And I had to watch my little brother, Jeffrey, burn to death right in front of me. And I did everything I could to pull him through the crib. He was 2 years old. And I couldn't. I burned my hands. I still have the burn marks from trying to pull my brother through the crib to save his life. My stepmother and father went to prison for that, but later got released. I cannot stand my stepmother. She's dead now. My father's dead. But I'll never forgive them for what they did. I only regret the fact that I could never tell my father that I loved him before he died. And that's the only thing that really hurts me, because he was influenced by his new wife. My stepmother hated me because I smelled like my mother. She constantly reminded me every day that she couldn't stand me because I smelled like my mother. And I guess it's something that when you divorce someone and you're the female, to do with that woman, her children have this odor about them that reminds her of the woman that my father first married to, Lois. My stepmother's name is Mary Smith. She's dead now. She was from Aiken, South Carolina. So, like I said, I really did not want the public to know, and I wasn't really seeking sympathy. Look, my martial arts was at a level that was different than anyone else, because it was something that I knew was going to save my life, and I devoted every minute and every second of my life to figure out human behavior, body language. When a person looked at me and he had hostile intentions, I picked it up just by the way he looked at me, by the way he stood. So I enhanced every aspect that I could of combat, martial arts, and interpreting behaviors that was threatening towards me, and I made it my goal to be able to defend myself against any assault or anyone who tried to harm me, my brother, or my sister. So that is why I came out with the story that I learned my martial arts in a Shaolin temple, and then from that, from a priest in the Savannah, on the Savannah River. And people like Danny Corm, he tried to rub salt in my wounds by exposing me as someone who has fantasies about this. He has no idea of the real story of why I did what I did. Questions?
I think he did acknowledge, though, this is, of course, Danny Corm, the documentary filmmaker. It's been seen, I guess, by, if my numbers are right here, over 150 million people now have viewed that documentary that he put together, Psychic Confessions, I believe it is, James Heidrich.
Yeah.
I think he did acknowledge the fact that you did have a troubled youth. I mean, he didn't go into the detail that you just have, obviously, with the house fires and everything else that occurred, but that was something that he did draw to listeners' attention. So we're going to come back to Corm hopefully here in a little bit, just a little further on down the road. In the meantime, I think we should give a shout out to Bo Keeley, of course, too, a good friend of yours. I guess is from the sounds of things, you guys have known each other for quite a few years, and he was, of course, instrumental in helping to set up today's interview. I had known about you for a while, quite a few years, as a matter of fact. And so when he mentioned the name James Heidrich, it's like, it was kind of, it's like, you know, no brainer really, as far as putting an interview together. There was, how and when, let's get on that. So it's great to have you here. This is, I guess, pretty much an exclusive, really.
Bo Keeley and I have known each other for many years. He was a student of mine in Salt Lake City. He went with me to one of my kumites in San Francisco and Palatown. He took pictures of the kumite. Even though they tried to restrict it, he still managed to secretly take pictures of the kumite. He went with me to Chicago to do a book deal with some people. He went with me throughout the United States. He videotaped and audiotaped my brother, my sister, and other members of my family. Bo Keeley has been a friend of mine for years. He is a professional athlete. He is an expert of everything. He's smart. He's healthy. He is a Keeley's cured. Bo Keeley has books out. He is the most intelligent person I have ever known. He's hard on me sometimes, but he has my interest at heart. He is a good man. And he's very instrumental in enhancing every aspect of my life, making it better in every way. And he's like a brother to me. I have a lot of respect for him. And Most of the people that I know, Bob Wallace, Bill Superfoot Wallace, Frank Dukes, all these people, Joe Corley out of Atlanta, the Battle of Atlanta, all these people that know Keeley and have spoken with him, have a lot of respect for him, and I too thank them for setting this up.
Bo King of the Road Keeley. We actually put an interview together with him. It's back in the archives there, Pirate Radio Podcast, via the Podomatic web presence that we have. And I'm not sure the exact episode number, but we'll add that to the show notes, of course. Yeah, Joe Eminon chiming in via the YouTube live streaming chat area that the guest level is too low. We understand that, Joe. Unfortunately, we're having to struggle with things here today because we've got him live via Coalinga State Mental, it's a hospital, I guess, is the
civil commitment facility in Coalinga, California.
State facility. Okay. The only way we can talk to him is via speakerphone. So we've done the best we can here today to get him to be able to join us on the show. We'll take care of things a little more in post-production as far as boosting levels and whatnot. And a big shout out, of course, to, let's see, we've got a few other, Mary Pia via minds.com just joined us a few minutes ago along with the two Pirate Joes. So that's great as the numbers continue to grow with today's show, which happens to be, I guess it's an exclusive once again. This is the first time really that you've done a show like this, an interview, in 35 some odd years. Is that not the case?
That is correct. About 35 years I haven't, and I've never, ever openly spoke about my childhood or anything like that to anyone. So wow. Your show would be the first that I've ever discussed this with anyone.
How about that? So, well, we really appreciate that, James. I don't know. It's tough for anyone to put themselves in another man's shoes, or just, you know, person in general. A lot of women, of course, have suffered abuse throughout the years at the hands of relatives and miscellaneous others. So bullying and, you name it, the gamut of things.
You're right about that. I witnessed my mother being beaten by, my father was a good father. He just happened to be a wife beater. It's unfortunate. I used to clench in pain when I saw my father beat my mother like he was beating a man. My father was a bouncer. My father is 6'4", 200 and something pounds. He was a bouncer in the South. He ran with the Valley Boys. That's a gang that ran the valley of Horse Creek Valley, South Carolina. That's in Langley, Bath, and Clearwater. My father, I witnessed my father take a man who held a .38 to his head. My father slapped this man with the .38 in his hand, still pointed at my father, and slapped him so hard he knocked him out. Took the gun, lifted it, and handed it back to him, and told him, "I'm sorry, I wasn't ready. You want to try that again?" My father was a fool.
That sounds pretty badass to me.
He was a badass.
It's a quote there, as you've just repeated, as I think it was your mother said on the Corum documentary, Psychic Confessions, that my husband wasn't a bad man. He just happened to be a wife beater. So, you know, that's, I guess, I think what your mom said, and that which left a lot of people scratching their heads. I know you've just said that yourself, but I think if people think about that, they can understand where you're coming from. So, and as you've stated, you love your dad, and he's passed away now, and, you know, we've all got our flaws and issues.
And passed away November 29th, 2016. When me and my brother was 7, I was 6, my sister was 5. Our stepmother abused us so bad that we snuck into the bedroom, reached into a drawer where my father kept a .38 sight, and we pulled out this gun. I'm 6 years old. And we tried to pull the hammer back on this gun. All three of us had our hands on the gun, aiming it at our mother while she was asleep in the bed at 2 o'clock in the morning. And when we pulled that hammer back, my father jumped up. My father's an ex-con, so he's like big time on alert, light sleeper. And when he saw what we were doing, he hit me so hard that he knocked not me, completely through the partition wall, completely through it, knocked me unconscious. And I never saw my father again after that, nor my stepmother. She wanted us out of the house, never to be seen again. Never mind the fact that she chained me to the trees like a dog, and that she threw piss and shit on me, and it was in a bucket. I mean, she just did some terrible things. Burned me, put cigarettes out on my back, slapped me, punched me, pulled my hair, cut all my hair off, shoved a rig-rack paddle up my rectum. She just was a terrible person. She tied my penis where I couldn't wet the bed because she didn't feel like changing the bed. I'm 6 years old. I can't help it. She was just a horrible person. Every time I got around her, she horrified me. I thought I was going to die. I thought she was going to do something to kill me. I was afraid to eat what she cooked because I thought she was going to poison me. I felt more comfortable eating slop from the dog or eating Alpo out of a can than I would eating her food. Type of trauma subjected me and my brother and sister to. She had her own kids. We were the first three of the ex-wife. You understand where I'm coming from?
Yep. Gotcha. I forget who made the comment here in the chat gallery, but they basically pointed out, and I think we're pretty much on the mark, talking about how it's kind of instinctive and animalistic, you know, and that you find in nature and in the animal kingdom with the smell of various offspring, and they, so an instinctive thing. And some, I guess your stepmom just wasn't able to mask it very well. Others throughout society presumably do, you know, with their stepkids. They don't necessarily treat them as well as they could or should. It's all a matter of degrees, I suppose. This is a pretty extreme case, though, of course, too, where things are out there pretty much in plain view.
I understand the notion of the smell, because when I want to remember someone, there's special people in my life. When I want to remember them, I take a certain type of cologne, only I use to identify that individual. And every time I smell it, I have no problem with thinking of this individual. Even body odors, I recognize that I don't think of anything, so I have a high sense of smell. Even going through different geographical areas in the world, I know what Greece smells like. I know what Egypt smells like. I know what Nicaragua, Honduras, El Salvador smells like. I know what the United States smells like. I know what Charleston, South Carolina smells like in the spring. I know what Savannah smells like. I know what Augusta smells like, Los Angeles. You understand what I'm saying? I know how smell can affect an individual's behavior. I know what death smells like. I definitely know what death smells like.
Yeah, I think it's something that a lot of people can relate to, the death being the pretty extreme example, but something that a few of us have witnessed and experienced. But this business of smells, the olfactory senses triggering memories, I know I can definitely relate to that, as yeah. I'm sure quite a few can. So let's just keep the ball rolling along here. We've got a whole bunch of show notes that we've put together, and we're hoping to cover some further ground. So now you appeared on the timeline here to your story is really kind of tricky. You appeared on shows like That's Incredible and What's My Line with Bob Barker. James Randi came out, the famous or somewhat habit notorious, very, you know, well-known debunker and stage magician. Basically, I guess you tried to fool them and tried to kind of pull the wool over people's eyes. And it was some great magic that you were doing there. There's no doubt about that. But they clearly demonstrated that the technique that you were using these were magic tricks that you were performing. So when was it that you first got into magic? During the same time that you were getting interested in the martial arts?
Harry Blackstone Jr.
Right.
He introduced me to magic. I perfected it and utilized it here and there, but I really got into the aspect of illusions when I was in the L.A. County Jail in 1977. I was involved with a group of individuals who went out hitchhiking one night, me and my friend, and we were picked up by a van full of some younger guys There were five of us in the band. We had no money. We wanted to party. And remember, I got released from Whitney Village. I've been institutionalized from age when I was born, basically, up until I was 15, 16 years old. And 31st of December 1975, I got released from Whitney Village in South Carolina. 77, I'm out in California trying to make a living as a model, as an not illusionist, but a martial artist. And I'm hitchhiking. I get picked up by a group of individuals. We picked up one male prostitute. His money was taken. He was robbed. He was tormented. And not by me, but by one of the individuals in the van. I did participate in a burglary that was his house. This guy was sexually assaulted in a way that was just humiliation, basically. So I go to jail. I realized that I put myself in a predicament that I had no control over, or maybe I did have control over, and I had to make sure that I never ran into the situation again, so I had to recreate myself, reinvent myself. So I did a lot of meditation, soul searching. I met this Franciscan monk by the name of Brother Gerald Schumann. He told me that I had to reintroduce myself to society in order to survive, that I couldn't hurt people. It was wrong to hurt people. And I agreed totally. So while I was in jail, in the L.A. County Jail, next door to a gentleman by the name of Maharian Perkovic, the alphabet farmer, I started working on illusions, making objects move by blowing on them, but it looked like they were moving on their own. And it was so convincing, I became a celebrity in the jail. I was known in the jail as Zane Leppard. I used an AKA, and I recreated myself. And that's when I first started working on sleight of hand. But it was a sleight of hand and illusions that were far beyond what you would normally see. This was like David Blaine type of stuff, street magic. You understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, sure. I've seen all the videos and tried to keep up to speed. It's some great stuff, and the people, once again, that following the show live here as it streams via YouTube, they really enjoy your magic as well. Some good quality stuff, so that you can definitely see why you've managed to fool a lot of people. Your breath technique, it's kind of yogic almost based, the way that you draw the breath up, I guess, from deep inside and like in the diaphragm area. Is that right? Is that how the technique is employed?
Well, the way I would do it is I would take a deep breath and breathe from the lower abdomen as opposed to the chest area, the cavity where you could see the movement. And I would puff it out in a way with my tongue arch to where it would be like a pin funnel of air. I didn't do this for the purpose of fooling anyone. I did it as a form of entertainment to enhance my ability to get more students. The issue about me saying this is psychic powers as opposed to illusions had nothing to do with me. It had to do with my manager saying, you can't tell them you're bluffing. You got to tell them you're using your mind. And because I had signed under contract with Chris Corey and Mike George, I had to stick to that. I had to do what they told me to do. And that's exactly why I represented it as psychic powers as opposed to illusions, because they believed that I could withstand any type of scrutiny that was put upon me when it came time to do that. Dan Graney and I are very good friends right now. He's helped me a lot. I have a lot of respect for him. Quorum's a different story. I can't say the same for Quorum, because Quorum went from trying to get me to admit that what I was doing was illusion to he busted me and he defrauded me, which he did not.
I'm sorry, who busted and defrauded who?
Danny Quorum claims he defrauded me. He doesn't say that I agreed to tell the world that what I did was an illusion. And he also cut and pasted together video to make it look like people like Sirhan or Bergovich or Charlie Manson, we call him Charlie. If you know him, you call him Charlie, was using me to get followers and stuff, which never happened.
Right. There was that whole theory or allegations of how you supposedly were being recruited by the Alphabet Bomber, I think is what the deal was. The aliens of America, and they felt because of your charisma and ability to attract followers that you would be a prime candidate to serve as a cult leader.
Well, that may be something that they allege, but it's just not true, because at the time that I met Maharian Kaberkovich, the Alphabet Bomber, I was known by no one. The only people that knew me were people in the martial arts community, and they didn't know me as an illusionist. They just knew me as a street fighter.
James, what year was this exactly? This is back in the early 80s, just before you appeared on national television?
Yeah, this was way before. This was in the 70s. I met Maharian Kaberkovich, Charles Manson, Doc Holliday, Joe Pegleg Morgan, and other people in the 70s prior to me ever becoming known to the world.
How is it then that you're appearing on national television, and the way it's been kind of, couched or phrased, harboring these dark secrets regarding your past and a criminal history of sorts, how is it that the world was not able to discover this until many years later, when I guess off-duty police officer happened to be watching the Sally Jesse Raphael show in 87, 88, 89, and recognized you. They managed to get their hands on you and have you put back in jail. What was the deal, though, when you appeared on That's Incredible and What's My Line? You had served a stint in jail. You'd done time for, as you, I think, were talking about earlier, this forcible confinement, kidnapping charges. I'm not sure what else there was to it, but you'd served your time out, and then you were essentially a free man in the mid-80s. Is that correct?
That's correct. I did my time 4 years in the county jail, in the L.A. County Jail, 4 years. That was one hell of an experience, meeting Doc Holliday. I'll stand by 1 second.
James sounds like has an incoming call or something that he has to attend to. So I believe that we are able to speak to him for pretty much as long as we like. We might be able to have him even join us in the after show. So, James, yeah, go ahead.
What happened?
Oh, it was just kind of keeping people up to speed. You had a bit of a side issue you had to attend to there, someone wanting your attention for a moment or two. But please continue.
Okay, so I was a free man, and I went to Salt Lake City. Like I said, I had to recreate myself. Sheriff Peter J. Pitches, Michael Ruber, he's an ex-LAPD officer who was in control of my housing in the Hall of Justice Jail. Michael Ruber was instrumental in relocating me, training, rehabilitation, since I had been locked up so long, provided me with a place to stay. I stayed with Captain John F. H. He's a Captain of the United States Marine Corps. Frank Dukes was instrumental in assisting in setting up certain training and combat training and stuff. Went to Salt Lake, opened up started working at the Salt Lake Athletic Club. I was directed to meet with certain individuals there and set up certain things that I was involved with, dealing with Black Ops, Special Operations, the U.S. Ninja Academy. My skills were tested. I was, I guess, rated, qualified for certain operations in Central America. I trained individuals in Salt Lake area for night operations at a river bomb plant. Fort Benning, Georgia, Fort Bragg. I went to the School of the Americans, which was transferred from Costa Rica into Georgia. The School of the Americans.
School of the Americas has quite a notorious reputation. They've closed down shop now and relocated, from what I understand. But let's back things up to not only Frank Dukes, who I guess the movie, I think it's Bloodsport, was based on, but also Michael Ruppert. If this is the same Michael Ruppert that I'm thinking of, and maybe even some of our listeners are thinking of, and you know he's passed away now, he basically, I think when you first met him, according to the notes that I've the notes that we've received here is that it's via the LA County Jail, your stint there back in, I guess it was the mid-70s, there was a notorious or, you know, the infamous third-floor food fight that you and, well, you, I guess, teamed up with someone and held quite a few people at bay, and there's quite an incident that occurred there. Why don't you just kind of fill people in on the third-floor food fight and how you met Michael Rupert?
1979, me and a guy named Virgil Kimmy were leaving our unit, 3100, going to the chow hall for breakfast. And there was an individual county jail officer who took it upon himself to snatch a bandana off the head of Virgil Kimmy. And he apparently didn't like it. I think he thought Virgil was involved with some type of Korean gang or something. Virgil Kimmy was the son of a Korean ruffian. These are people who are very well known for martial arts. You're in Korea, South Korea, so you would know about the Korean ruffian. His father is Wake Kim, the well-known martial artist. Virgil was assaulted. I defended his honor. He defended my honor. We ran into the third floor chow hall at the main central jail. This is at 7:34 in the morning. About 7:35 the next day in the morning, we had 17 to 18 officers at bay. We had all their riot gear equipment called the Doom Squad in one corner and them in another corner. We had combated all of these officers who tried to apprehend us in the chow hall. We were the only ones in the chow hall. We used pots and pans to defend ourselves until we could get their own weapons. We would go underneath the tables and kick one here, kick one there, knock one down, take their helmet, take their baton. They had long batons. And each one of these staff members, these LAPD squad officers, was over 200 and something pounds, at least 6'4", 6'5", 6'6". I was 18 years old. Virgil was like 29 or something like that. So, yeah, that in itself drew a lot of attention from the local prosecutors who refused to prosecute us because they couldn't agree to take the stand before court and explain how two individuals managed to hold at bay 17 officers in riot training. And the fact of the matter is this should have been avoided had they had followed jail policy and procedures. And as a result of this, they placed me and Virgil Kimmy both in high power, changed our custody from general population to a red wristband, K10 HDV, which is highly dangerous and violent. That's what that means. And we were keep away. Everywhere I went under special escort. Chained and two or three pair of leg irons, two or three pair of handcuffs, Martin chains around the waist, housed me in 1700, 1750, which is how I met up with Doc Holliday, James Holliday, the DGF general, other individuals, Maharan Springbridge. And later on, when I started being prepared for pre-release, which was in 79, they moved me to the Hall of Justice jail under the care of Sergeant Michael Rupert. I was on 1310 at the Hall of Justice jail. I was the only inmate there. No other inmate was there but me. The whole floor. It cost them $30,000 a day to house me, according to court documents and newspaper reports. Look at the LA Times for that period. You'll see where they talk about housing me there and how I'm one of the most high-skilled inmates in the LA County Jail, even though my time wasn't notorious. But Michael Rupert and four other individuals, I have no idea who they were. They were in chutes. I was quizzed for 9 months, shown maps by Rupert and his group, his individual employees. No other staff members other than Sergeant David Bullis, who is a former airborne ranger, Brother Gerald Schumann was allowed. Peter J. Pitches was allowed to come there. They educated me on Central America. I went through and the inspirations.
cutting out a little bit there, James. In fact, cutting out quite a lot. So, but Michael Rupert is probably best known for his role in exposing, along with former journalist Gary Webb, both now unfortunately deceased, gone far too soon, helping to expose the CIA's role in narcotics and drug trafficking, primarily cocaine-based, it would seem, during the mid-1980s, right around the period that we're looking at here now, and, you know, essentially flooding the streets of America, L.A., and beyond with this, this thing known as crack cocaine. So Gary Webb, of course, wrote for the Mercury Sun or Mercury Times, something along those lines. But
San Jose Mercury News, him and John Hoagland was a good friend of mine. When I was in Central America, El Salvador particularly, Hoagland was killed during an operation that was done there.
Well, let's go into that.
Yeah, you're right. Our operations in Central America dealt specifically with showing that the Reagan administration lied to the American public, that the problem was the Contras and not the Sandinistas, and that they were doing everything they could to destabilize the democratic and social movement during the 79 and 80s. I guess the U.S. provided financial, logistical, and military support to the Contras and the rebels in Nicaragua, used terrorist tactics to infiltrate or to just demolish whatever opposition they could. And the team known as the Enterprise, who provided financial support to the United States government, or not the government, but to certain generals, to help assist in their destabilizing the Central America.
Yeah, this is a big scandal, of course, too, involving Oliver North, George Bush Sr., Skull and Bones, POTUS 41, just all the usual suspects, really. So you even met, I guess, according to what our research tells us, William Casey came and visited your dojo in Salt Lake City.
Individuals that he handpicked for operations, and we reported to him and him only. Most of the times he would come and see us unexpectedly. He would just show up. He was very direct on what he wanted to do. He did not want any connection with any official operations, and this is the way he did this little thing. It wasn't just me that he did this to. He did it as well with other individuals, including Frank Duke.
Is this the original Dirty Dozen that Bo Keeley has referenced? Frank Dukes, yourself?
Yeah, the Dirty Dozen was a group of individuals, including myself, of ex-cons, ex-drug dealers, ex-military, ex-Navy SEALs. It was 12 of us. It was two teams. There's only six per team. One team one area, and one team would go another area. One team provided direct assistance to whatever with the backup team on standby. Yeah, the Dirty Dozen was the team that I was a part of, also known as the DELCON 5 unit, which was a covert operation team of the Dirty Dozen. Frank Duke was part of this team. Later, he went into the Union in Czechoslovakia.
We got a question got a few comments and questions for you here in the YouTube chat area. One of our members wants to know whether you have any idea about there's a Facebook webpage in place that is a tribute to you or some, I have not seen it myself yet. It's the first I've heard of it actually. So it covers your history and biography and life story. Do you know about your Facebook webpage?
I have never seen it. But there is a Facebook that was put up for me by Bo Keeley and a gentleman out of Utah, Mark North. But I haven't seen it.
Speaking of websites,
I don't know what it looks like.
Yeah, because they don't let you
to the internet while I'm at.
Yeah, we're going to get into that a little more here just in a minute or two, hopefully. But what other websites has Keeley put together for you? I know there's a couple that people can find. Do you know the addresses just off the top of your head? for the website pages that he's put together for you?
Oh, it's James Heidrich Facebook. We got another one, James Heidrich. That's incredible. And then you have dailyspeculation.com. And then just you put in James Heidrich of Bokeh and you see all kind of stuff on Daily Speculation. Go B-O-K-E-E-L-Y at, I think it's hotmail.com or something like that. That's the email thing. I know I have an email, but I don't remember what it was. I just know that you can call me direct the way you did, and you can call my answering service, my voicemail. So.
Yeah, we'll add all these.
You set up a lot of stuff for me.
Well, you're not kidding. I mean, you talk about a good friend. He's been there for you, it seems like, for quite a few years. So,
well, you know, he's put out the book of James Heidrich and photos. It's on Amazon. Go to Amazon.com and you can see it there. And he's working on my autobiography right now. The story has to be told, and it has to be told right, and it has to be the truth. He's got all the documents. He's got over 200 or 300 pounds of documents from 1960 supporting everything that we have spoken about. So he's got photographs of everything to do with military operations or dojo, escapes, the transportation from Georgia to Arkansas, the Sheriff King, you know, out of Clarksville, Arkansas, Eddie King. He's got everything.
Why no major Hollywood movie production or more kind of up-to-date documentary project, even a book, of course, too? That would go nicely along with things. But why none of this has been done, I have no idea. But, I mean, you talk about a great story.
Well, you understand I've been missing for 30 years. I've been here, and I've been silent. And Keeley has convinced me of the importance of getting my story. I'm 58 years old now. I got locked up when I was 27 years old. 27, 1988 when I got locked up. I haven't been out. I've been locked up ever since. I'm in Kalinga now. I'm no longer on parole. My sentence was completed in 1998. And I haven't been back to prison since. So I've been quiet. And a lot of people frown on the fact that I'm a convicted sex offender. It's a taboo that people are frown on. They don't understand my story. Most people don't care. So we have to play it by ear, I guess.
Let's get into that now that we've addressed the elephant in the room, this business of sex offenses and all the particulars of your case and whatnot, but you petitioned to have your case heard before a jury. We've actually looked into this and would like to maybe try something similar with, well, it's a Free John Ford case is what we here at Pirate Radio Podcasts are speaking out in support of and are doing all that we can to raise the exposure of Mr. Ford's case. People can, of course, find the roundtable show we did last year in the archives. We have a new show coming up in just a couple weeks, actually, a new roundtable. He's a UFO political prisoner, same kind of deal where he ended up getting warehoused, essentially, in a psychiatric facility, Long Island, I guess, Suffolk County, New York. And it's something that, you know, more people need to hear about his story, obviously. And
you're right about that. They have me detained for a crime that I might commit in the future. Because what they're doing is they're saying, okay, we're locking you up in a state mental institution because of your past behavior. And until that changes, you are considered a threat to society because you suffer from a mental disorder that predisposes you to commit a crime in the future. That's the key element of keeping me locked up. And the problem with that synopsis is that your past never changes. So they keep you here until you die. I have seen 81 patients, my peers, die in the last 20 years. 81. They do not let them go. And it is a warehouse. And the diagnosis on individuals here is ridiculous. You have individuals here who have absolutely no business being locked up in a mental institution because they have no mental disorder. They committed a criminal offense, which was a sex crime. Either it's rape, lewd conduct, exposure, or whatever. They have no business being here. Their crime was a criminal offense. If they suffered a mental disorder, at least in the state of California, California has a law under Penal Code Section 1368.1 that says that if your crime is a result of a mental disorder, you will be sent to a state mental hospital for treatment and then released once you get better. Now, if any of us suffered from a disorder or our crime was a result of a disorder, we would have kept under that law, 1368.1. However, when we were sentenced, in my case, I was forced medicated, and I changed my plea, but nevertheless, when I was sentenced, if the courts believed that my competency was affected, my behavior was a result of my mental illness, they would have sent me to the state hospital at that time. But that didn't happen. My competency never got questioned because what they said I did was a criminal act, lewd and lascivious act, inappropriate massage to the feet, the back, the neck, the leg, and stuff like that. Now, if I had been suffered from a mental disorder, they would have sent me to a state hospital then. But no, they waited until I completed my sentence, told me nothing about a mental disorder, and said, after when my wife, who is now dead, God rest her soul, my wife for 13 years died of bone marrow cancer on May 17, 2000. She was there to pick me up at Folsom State Prison. Eric Menendez was my celly when I paroled. She was told that because it was believed that I now had a mental disorder, they're going to send me to a taskadown. And that's how that started. June 18th, 98, I went to Casca Daryl, and I haven't been out since.
Kind of a bait and switch, really, where, definitely pretty sneaky. You do your time, and you're ready to be released, and then suddenly from out of the blue, they pull that on you and others,
because
it seems,
I
too.
I knew nothing about this prior to that.
Come again?
I knew nothing about being suspected I had a mental disorder. I had no mental disorder while I was in prison. I've never had a mental disorder in my life. Even when I was housed at Witten Village as a child, George Powers in Miami, former governor, ordered me to be released from Witten Village because I had no mental disorder. How dare them take a 9-year-old child, place him in a mental institution, and say he has a mental disorder when he didn't? So they released him. And it's the same thing here. I have no mental disorder. I committed a criminal act. And lewd and lascivious act is a criminal act. That's it. There's nothing mentally disordered about what I did or accused of doing.
I guess then from a particular standpoint, it would almost seem as if this is politically motivated, if anything.
It is politically motivated because they treat you like a prisoner here. They do not treat you like a civil commitment. I'm housed here under Welfare Institutions Code, Section 6600, and it says that I will be housed here until the disorder no longer exists. It says that I do not have to be amenable to treatment, and treatment does not have to work. Now, what kind of code would say that and not describe the housing as being punitive, retribution, and deterrence? Treatment does not have to work, and you do not have to be amenable to treatment. Why am I here then?
Well, as Louis Theroux covered in his documentary, Coalinga is largely known as a place for pedophiles, was the name of the episode that he put together. So this all stems and goes back to these alleged sex crimes. Why don't you flesh things in a little more then, if you would, and just kind of take us back to how this all came about. And then they use this suddenly from out of the blue, even though you'd already served your time. What was it that you are alleged to have actually done with these, I guess, youths or minors, mostly underage individuals? Can you give us more details, if you will?
I had some youngsters. I went to from the Battle of Atlanta after I had won the national championship in breaking and competition for Joe Corley in 1987. Grandmaster Ed Parker asked me, him and Professor Tanaki, Bob White, asked me to come to Long Beach and do a 100-inch concrete break.
Ed Parker, too, let's not forget, was one of Elvis Presley's best-known karate instructors.
The glasses that Elvis Presley wears that says EP on them, actually Ed Parker. That's not for Elvis Presley, it's Ed Parker. Those came from Ed Parker. Ed Parker was a member of the Black Tigers, which provided bodyguard services to the governor of Hawaii. He also provided bodyguard services for Elvis Presley, Mike Stone, Ed Parker and his group, including Stephen Seagal, protected Elvis Presley. They were very good friends, and Ed Parker was like a father to me. He has always been there for me. I went to Long Beach, or Huntington Beach, to prepare for the break. I did breaks in the Huntington Beach area. Some of the kids that I'm accused of being involved with sexually were people who assisted me in setting up my bricks. They went around and handed out flyers for people to go to the tournament and do the big break, the 100-inch concrete break. Everything went well, and then about 7 or 8 months after I had left Huntington Beach, one of the kids got arrested for possession of marijuana, driving under the influence or something like that. I'm not going to say the individual's name because I don't want to put it out. He's serving time in prison right now in Hawaii, but and he's serving time for a vehicular homicide. So this kid's life was all screwed up. I assisted him. He arrested for possession of methamphetamines and driving under the influence of something. And when they questioned him or something about why he did whatever he did or whatever it was, however his questioning was, he said that because I massaged him or inappropriately touched him, he got into drugs or something. He had been in drugs way before I had even known him. I figured him out working and helping me would keep him away from that, which it did, but every now and then he would get drunk and throw up in the car and stuff. So that's what precipitated the interest in, well, a hybrid predator or whatever. Next thing you know, you had other people saying something and other people, the story changed. Even the police report says that they don't know what to believe. These guys keep changing their story. But nevertheless, because of a political issue with them trying to extradite me from Georgia to California, the story got worse and more in depth. Of course, Sheriff Eddie King intercepted the extradition team and told him he's not going to honor their extradition because they had no warrant. They illegally tried to extradite me. One thing led to another, and that's where I got charged with multiple counts of lewd touching, massages, and stuff like that.
You were living with Sheriff Keene at the time, I guess. He was a friend of yours or a caretaker of sorts. You played with his kids, according to what he has stated, yeah, I guess, on the record.
Sheriff Keene intercepted the team that tried to extradite me from Georgia to California. The Extradition Corporation of America, based out of Tennessee, they put 23 of us in a van designed for 12 individuals. I broke out of the handcuffs 3 or 4 times. They pulled over in Ozark, Alabama, and tried to regroup, get another team. They had more people come in. And then they went from Ozark, Alabama, into Ozark, Arkansas. And when they got to Ozark, Arkansas, I started acting really bad, breaking the cuffs, telling them, you ain't going to take me nowhere, and I got other people to say the same thing. That's when they realized they had to separate me from the other individuals. So they said, well, why don't you take him to Johnson County and Clarksville, Arkansas, the Sheriff King will hold him. So on the way to 2015, we started rocking the band, moving from side to side. But the way we did it is, so of course, I'm using psychological warfare this time. I'm saying I'm going to use my mind, and I'm going to turn this van over if you don't do something. We started moving. I whispered to him to stay from side to side. We shut the van so hard that it reared up on two wheels, and it scared him. So they pulled over and had them call the highway patrol to escort us in to Clarksville. And when we got there, they told us, yeah, whatever you do, don't look him in the eye. He'll hypnotize you. It was crazy.
Yeah.
And Sheriff King, he accepted me at the jail, and he said, well, you guys got a warrant for his arrest? You got a warrant? And they said, well, we don't have a warrant. And I said, well, wait a minute. How do you have him and you don't have a warrant? Well, let him take him to the next county. He says, oh, no, no, no. You done dropped him off here now. Nah, he's in my custody. You don't have a warrant for his arrest. You're not taking custody of him. That's how it started. And when Sheriff King called California and said, what's the warrant number for his arrest? They gave him a warrant number that was fictitious. Sheriff Eddie King will tell you straight that they did not have a warrant. I talk with Eddie King every day. I talked with him just a couple of weeks ago. Eddie King is retired now. He was a sheriff for Johnson County and Clarksville, Arkansas. He's a good man, very God-fearing man. And his family tucked me in. Sheriff King did a writ of habeas corpus, got the U.S. magistrate to allow him to take me into his custody. He took me home with him. We went home. About saying when a guy took a guy hostage, typically I showed him how to maneuver to get a shot on the guy so he wouldn't kill him. He got him in the stomach instead of shooting him in the upper body. The guy survived. The hostage survived. I dressed up like Santa Claus and did a thing for the kids there. I slept in the same room with his son, Zachary, and Zachary was 12 at the time, and I talked with Zachary today. This allegation California made is just ridiculous. There was nothing I could do because they forced medicated me with Haldol, and I ended up pleading guilty to something that I would up.
Yeah, really strong, heavy dosage of Haldol, I guess is
yeah,
what the...
40 milligrams, and right before I would go to court, they would enhance it to 60 milligrams. They documented this.
And they get away with it too. That it's you know it's I think it's more than just you. It happens on all.
Because I pleaded guilty.
Right.
I signed a plea agreement that I couldn't even see because the medication. One of the side effects of Haldol is that when you look up close, you can't see what you're doing.
Yeah. You got roughed up pretty bad there too, I guess, from what I understand, with the America extradition. Corporation, they kind of they slapped you around a little bit, I guess. Is that not the case?
Yeah. They put me in cuffs, slapped me around. They abused me. They threatened to force medicate me if I didn't cooperate. They brought my behavior on by the way they treated me. When I started objecting to the fact that you had 23 people in a van designed for two, couldn't even breathe. We were so tight, the odor and the heat was incredible. They just were insensitive to how they were transporting us, like we were cattle or something. And it was offensive. And when I objected to it, they want to push me up and grab me around and push my head to the wall. And then that's when I say, dude, do you even know who I am? I will take these cuffs off and walk away from here. And it's not, I'll take your guns. I will take your nightclub. I will take over this van, and we'll be driving to a hotel tonight. Do you really want to do this? This is the way I was acting. This is what I told him. And when I started taking cuffs off, I didn't have to do anything else. They started believing what I was saying.
No guard could break him. No prison could cage him. I think it's one of the.
I respect law enforcement. Don't abuse me. I know what it's like to be abused. My mother abused me. My father abused me all my life. I know how to deal with people like that. I trained and learned from a young age how to deal with people like that. And I'm very good at it. Treat me with dignity and respect, and I will show you the same courtesy.
You've got quite a record in history, and we, by the way, just to let people know, we've only got a few minutes left here, and we've got to wrap things up. Hopefully we can have you join us in the after show, the Rogues Gallery segment of things. It's more like the premium kind of exclusive content that we put together for our Patreon supporters, and anyone, of course, that chooses or decides to join us, we'll send you a copy of the recording and show that we do as well there for that end of things.
I'd like to have my address out there. And a way for people to contact me if they want to get a hold of me.
Absolutely.
I really appreciate it.
You betcha. Well,
I would love to get letters from people.
Let's hear it then. You betcha. Yarg.
Okay. My address is James Heidrich, 967-0, Unit 2, 24511, West Jane Avenue. That's Jayne Avenue, Coalinga, Coalinga, California, 93210. 93210, guys, Coalinga, California, USA, 93210. Of course, phone number, you have my phone number, the 559-934-1894, 559-934-0369. 559-935-3098. My office number is 559-935-8759. You know, you can send me letters. You know, I could always use thumb drives, 64 gigs, 128 gig thumb drives, whatever. Send me a letter, write me. I have a 27-inch television, Samsung, and it has a media player on it. And I can take and put a thumb drive in there and watch movies. I like history. I like documentaries. People can go to Amazon and order thumb drives, 120 gigs. They can even order hard drives, 3 terabytes, 2 terabytes, 1 terabyte. They can order tennis shoes. They can order all kind of stuff and send to me. I work size 12. I mean, they can send me anything that ain't glass, no metal, no alcohol. We don't work here. We get $1 an hour, which is slave labor, and we can only work two hours at a time. You can only work for 2 years, and they put you off for 6 months, and you work 2 years later. It's hard to get anything here. I mean, we have a grill where they serve good food, but you have to have money to buy food. And if you have no income, you can't get any of the food. The bank doesn't have the money to feed you good. Very poor food. That's why most people are dying.
They're certainly collecting a lot of taxpayer money, I guess, you know, to...
Of course they are. $280,000 per patient.
Per year?
Per year. $280,000 a year per patient, as opposed to $50,000 a year per inmate in the prison. People can come visit me. If they're local, they can come visit me at Coalinga. There's a lot of good things about Coalinga, but there's a lot of bad things. I mean, I'd rather be here than in prison, but it's hard to swallow when they sit there and they treat you like a child and they expect you to behave like an adult. It's hard to swallow.
Do they screen your content? If we were to, or someone, anyone out there was to send you a thumb drive, would they go through your content and, like, look at the movies and everything you've got to make sure you don't have anything?
You can't send a thumb drive with movies on it. You have to send, anything you send thumb drive-wise or hard drive has to be in the original package.
How do you get a hold of the documentaries and movies then, like in digital form? How do you receive those or get your hands on them exactly?
Here who have access to the internet and they'll download it, or I get it smuggled in by staff. I can get anything smuggled in here by staff. Drugs, alcohol, anything.
It sounds like you're more than willing to...
Incredible play.
You're going on the record and stating this too, so you don't have any problem.
Absolutely.
In...
Absolutely. Me and Bokeh is fixing to bust a bubble on this.
And it kind of seems like we're moving things in that direction, at least to let the public hear about where you are at in life at this particular moment and all everything to do with your backstory, of course. Let me just, the last question, I guess, and we have so much more that we are hoping to cover here in the after show, but you actually work in the capacity of the facility sort of advisor or counselor or a coordinator of some sort?
I'm an in-house litigation coordinator. We have a case called Hydrick versus Wilson, Hydrick versus Hunter. It's in the Ninth Circuit. It's a class action lawsuit, 1983, that I filed back in 99 against the California Department of Mental Health, charging them with abusing the SBP law by housing us under in conditions that are inconsistent with the SBP law. They're inconsistent with the legislative intent that we be housed here for treatment as opposed to punishment. There can be no punitive aspect to our housing at all, but there is. We have staff members who work here who have no business working here. They're victims of rape. They're victims of child molestation. They're victims of sexual assault. And they hate sex offenders. They demonstrate that by their demeanor, by their interaction with us, by their enforcement of rules and regulations that have not been approved by the California Administrative Procedures Act, by the Office of Administrative Law. They're enforcing rules and regulations that are tailored towards a prison environment as opposed to a state hospital civil commitment. You can't enforce rules and regulations that are not consistent with our the legislative's intent for our purpose of our placement here. You understand what I'm saying?
Right.
So, yes, I'm heavily involved with the legal aspect of my housing and care here. Remember, every aspect or element that I'm in, whether a prison or a jail, I'm going to always do what I can to make my stay better and my peers stay better.
Understood. Understood.
I'm in here. I will do everything I can to challenge the wrongful detention of people who they locked up for crimes they might commit in the future.
Well, yeah, minority port pre-crime.
If you want more information, this is something you should know. If you want more information about what conditions I'm under, there's a website you can go to. It's www.defenseforsvp.com.
Defense
get a copy of my case
for SVP.
And other information pertaining to the Kalinga State Hospital. They got government reports, legal news, professional papers, self-help materials, opinion papers, and more. And me and Michael St. Martin opened up this website for the public. It's an incredible law. It is unbelievable. When they challenged our lawsuit, they used the Muhammad Atta versus Asqua, which is the detention of military combatants at Guantanamo Bay, as a reason that we cannot sue for money, that we're in the same category as terrorists.
Ah.
Military combatants.
And that, of course, all under the guise and pretense of the Unpatriot Act, I believe, as it's known, correct?
That's right.
The Unpatriot
Absolutely.
Act. Yes. So I have no doubt whatsoever that there are quite a few people that are behind bars or find themselves locked up in psychiatric institutions who really should not be there at all, of course, and that they're getting a pretty raw deal. Justice is not being served. There is just too much warehousing that is going on. It's a major cash cow and an industry and an area and part of society that is in dire and desperate need of reform. You, in many ways, could end up becoming the poster boy, at least on one, in some ways, I suppose, for in the eyes of who knows how many. But there's been a few people over the course of our discussion here in the YouTube streaming chat area that have concurred and agree with essentially what I'm presenting and, hitting on here. So they seem to be quite sympathetic to your case and the situation you find yourself in. But just any last closing remarks then, James, because we're gonna shift gears here and transition our way on into the after show. Just any last things you'd like to let our listeners know?
Well, yeah, I would like your listeners to know one thing. I'm not a pedophile. I have no interest in children other than trying to enhance their knowledge about martial arts and the world. I have no interest sexually in children. A child did not satisfy me sexually. It just wouldn't work. I am sorry that I'm in a position like this. I'm sorry that questions, you can call me. You can write me. I have no qualms. If you have an interest in telling my story, please contact me. I would be more than happy to cooperate. I would be honored. I have nothing to hide. I have documents. I have video footage. I have this. I have everything. Whatever you want. You're more interested in what I have to say. I'm interested in telling it. The only thing I have left is story. If you can help me, I would be more than happy. I'm so grateful to have an opportunity to tell you my story. And there's even more that you haven't heard. Like I said, I appreciate this opportunity.
Well, that's great. And actually, well, we were going to bring the captain in here. I'm not sure if he can be found or not, but hang on just a second. Captain Long John, do we have him? We have the ship's captain who sometimes does show up and have a few things to share with listeners as well as guests. Are you there, Captain?
Yeah, I'd be here, Jeffy. This is, I've been listening the whole time. In fact, quite the show and presentation going on, the interview with James Hydrock. So, James, this is really quite something, and, you know, we pirates are very interested in not only booty and plunder, but also seeing that justice is held to account. So anything we can do to further highlight or promote the exposure of your case, the better. Thank you very much, James. Best of luck, and we'll definitely be seeing you again.
Captain Long John Sinclair. Well, how about that? So,
I barely understand what he's saying.
He was just commending you and wishing you all the best, really, was all that was happening there. So on that note, stand by, James. We're going to head over and transition into the after show. People can join us there in the Rogues Gallery. We'll probably set things up in Skype and maybe manage to keep James on board here as we do that. So thank you once again, Mr. Hydrick. Happy sailing.
Thank you.
Now, there we be. Having carefully looked over each of our navigation panel instruments, checking every level, switch, knob, and dial, by all accounts and indications, we indeed see it's time once again to drop anchor inside the bay and draw an end to another week of Pirate Radio Podcasts. Don't forget, if you're looking for a little more free-flowing action, we've likely got another great Rogues Gallery after show coming up next in either Google Hangouts or Skype. Also, if you've in any way enjoyed or found yourself benefiting from the shows we've tirelessly produced over the past 16 or so odd months, you might want to drop by our new Patreon tip jar page and lend a little support. Missouri-based podcaster and fellow Minds.com personality Innerverse recently decided to take a chance on throwing us a bone. Along with virtual Buccaneers Kelly Freeman and Carol Sloan, that now brings our official number of patrons up to 3. Presently commanding a whole 6 big ones per episode, our impeachable longshoreman math skills tell us we're on course this year to set aside around $150 in charity. Help to keep those numbers growing over on Patreon, and we'll be able to extend even more of a generous pirate hand. Coming up next week, same time as always, flying rainbow lasagna mystic and spiritual adventurer, the lovely Aurora. Penciled in for what promises to be a total day of discord, June 23rd, Minds.com Satori D will be joining us to discuss the Infinite Imaginarium Project and more. South American-based ayahuasca and shaman experts Peter Gorman and Alan Shoemaker will be rounding things out on the night of the 30th for what is promising to be an all-too-trippy month of June. If you yourself have an intriguing idea for a guest or story, you can either drop us a line directly over on WPRPN.com or fire us a quick email via PirateOneRadio@gmail.com. WPRPN.com network subdomain links are also now available. Great for artists,
musicians, podcasters, social media personalities, or pretty much just any landlubber. Looking to boost their online visibility, presence, and reach, basic accounts can be launched for only $15 a year. Staking your claim now helps not only strengthen you and the network, we're also looking out for the little guy. That's right, folks. Half of all WPRPN's profits are redirected right back into the hands of the people who really need it most. Community charity. After all, we are the Robin Hood. You can further embark on your own personal pirate journey by liking, subscribing, commenting on, sharing, and following any of our main social media channels via Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, Google+, or Minds.com. So don't forget to become engaged. Until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Tally-ho!